I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Paul Hawken. He's an environmentalist and entrepreneur and the author of several books, including The Ecology of Commerce, A Declaration of Sustainability. He will be speaking at the Lensic tomorrow evening, sponsored by the Green Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Is that a real cafe back there? I hear all these people.
It is indeed. So you wrote the book, The Ecology of Commerce, 20 years ago. You revised it in 2010, and in it you spell out in a very explicit manner how business as practiced in our country today is basically leading to an earth that is uninhabitable by human beings and many other species, essentially because we are using more than we're giving back. We're poisoning the water, the earth, and the air in various ways. And in the 20 years since this book has been published, there's been a huge positive change in consciousness. Has there been a corresponding change for the better in terms of earth friendliness on the part of business?
Oh, for sure. It's been a sea change in business. The literacy within companies with respect to the environment is extraordinarily different. When the book came out in 1993, I managed to make enemies of both environmentalists and the business community. I mean, because each thought of the other is the problem. And the idea that there could be an ecology of commerce is anathema. So I wrote two books before that, Next Economy and Growing Business, and they were reviewed by 200 different publications, each one of them. And the Ecology of Commerce, even though it was a bestseller, wasn't reviewed by any business publication in the United States. They just boycotted it. And at the same time, the environmental press also sort of criticized it and avoided it. So it was kind of like a pariah book, actually. But in the intervening time, there is this extraordinary literacy that has happened in corporations. Having said that, that literacy sometimes is subordinated to greenwashing. Sometimes it's used to just buffalo people. I'm at a Marriott right now, giving a talk at a university here in Virginia, and you know, it's got this little thing in the bathroom. It says, you know, we care about the planet, and we care about just as much as we care about you. And if you want to save the planet, put your towel back on the rack, you know, which just saves them detergent. There's not one thing about this building that is remotely green or could not have been done 20 years ago. There's no LEED certification. There's no particular energy efficiencies. There's no changes in the material and paints and VOCs. It's absolutely the same. So it's both, you know. There's extraordinary companies that have emerged, that have come out. There are a few companies like Interface in Atlanta who have made really fantastic changes. There are big companies that do things that are really quite wonderful and keep it sort of close to their chest, like Canon. But on the whole, the rate of damage is increasing, primarily because the metabolism is increasing. The amount of stuff that's being made and sold is increasing exponentially.
Now, one of the things that I think is a really big sticking point is the whole concept of growth. So is it possible to have a healthy economy that's also a growing economy? Some would say infinite growth is a kind of cancer metaphor. Others say that it's absolutely necessary to a healthy economy.
Well, I mean, we have to ask ourselves the same question about our bodies. I mean, do we want to grow in size or grow in quality? I mean, at a certain point, you want to stop growing in size. But you don't think of yourself as stopping growing or learning or developing. And economies can do the same thing. Right now, I mean, what we do is we steal the future and sell it in the present and call it GDP. And we could easily have an economy that heals the future, and we make money from that in the present, and we call it whatever we want, GDP as well. So those choices exist, because when you heal the future, you're actually creating assets for the future, and you can monetize it in real time. Corporations do that all the time. But right now, the paradigm is to actually extract from the future. And so the growth syndrome is now finding itself in trouble because resources are scarce. One resource is the atmosphere. It's the sink of carbon. It's where we place carbon. It's full, getting fuller. The oceans are another sink. They're getting full. The oceans are starting to acidify, destroying coral reefs, destroying fisheries, destroying life. So the growth paradigm has already hit its limits. It's just that it doesn't correlate. It doesn't see those as its limits. And then you have people like the Koch brothers and others who just lead the world, really, in terms of corporate perfidy, really just funding anything that will confuse people by advertisements or lobbying or in supporting candidates that are demagogues. And this is confusing because most people don't really have the time to, you know, get up to speed on this, and they're susceptible to the influence of media and advertising, you know, from political candidates. And so you have a country divided, and common sense is a casualty, and demagoguery is the victor.
Explain to our listeners the concept of carrying capacity. There's this chilling story in The Ecology of Commerce of these reindeer that were into a small number of reindeer, a few dozen, were introduced to a place called St. Matthew Island. What happened there?
Well, they bred, and they had no predators, and so they kept breeding. And at a certain point, they ran out of food. You get this thing called a 29th day. In other words, you get this sort of climactic period where you have a tremendous population, and then within a couple of years, the population completely collapses. And that is just it's a true story, but it's a morality tale for what's called the 29th day. And that's the analogy of algae on a pond, and algae can grow and doubles every day, and you don't think anything about it. On the 29th day, only 50% of the pond is covered with algae. But on the 30th day, it's 100%, and the pond is dead.
Right.
And so exponential growth, you know, is such a siren song. You know, it's like so attractive. And I think all of us, and, you know, we have to be honest, you know, we have this sense of I want to get mine before it's over, or, well, I deserve to get the bigger home, or the better this, or the second that, or, you know, I mean, everybody has this. This is human desire, and the problem with that is that it really promotes the idea that we're individuals, that we're alone, this delusion that we're a self, instead of a community of life. And in traditional cultures, certainly in the Native American cultures, they very well understood that they were kith and kin, that they were a part of a community of life, and that they acted that way, and that in those communities they had very strong codes of ethics, so that if somebody acted individually, selfishly, at the expense of the whole, they would be shunned. There was ways of not hurting them, but shunning them, so that they knew that they felt that they were in fact pariahs within their community. And they do that for a year or two, and then the person would, you know, come back around and realize that their life depended on the well-being of others. We don't have that because of this tremendous abundance that has come forth from injecting a billion years of carbon into the economy through fossil fuels. And so we have this sense of abundance, which is temporal, and therefore we act as individuals. And in that, we get this tragedy of the commons, where the cumulative actions of our individual needs and wants aggregates into something that is so damaging, and now is becoming more present. And environmentalists have always been sort of burdened with the problem that they're talking about the Chicken Little thing, like, you know, the sky is falling, and people look up and say, oh, the sky's not falling, you know.
Right, but maybe it is.
But it is.
At this point.
But they're seeing ahead. They're seeing around the curve. They're seeing over the horizon. And then they're going back, and people are saying, well, it's fine, you know. And both are true.
Well, and we are rewarding people who are the ultimate selfish individualists. I mean, we're not even not shunning them. They're the ones who are making the money and getting the
We idolize them. We put them on covers of magazines. We put them on TV. We interview them. We go to them for advice, you know. I mean, the richer the person, the more we think, oh, my God, they must be so smart. So, yeah, no, our values are there. But the concentration of capital is also creating the values, you know, so the children are weaned on this stuff and this sort of Promethean idea of the individual.
We're talking to environmentalist and author Paul Hawken. That story of the deer was so chilling to me because it seemed like such a, and I'm sure you wrote it this way, it's such a parable for where we could go as a species, namely human beings. We exceed the carrying capacity of the earth. We continue to live off the, as you say, as off the future by degrading the topsoil and basically making a, and all kinds of things, and making it so that the food supply 10, 50, 100 years from now won't carry the people on this earth. How do you calculate that? Are there people who've figured out really how many people this green earth can comfortably hold and feed?
Yeah, there is. There's a footprint network, global footprint network, and there's other people who've been working on this for years and years, and it's always a guesstimate. I mean, it's not an exact science. It depends how people live as well. And there are those who'd say that we've overshot that already, we're living as if there was three planets instead of one. There are those who would say if we radically changed how we lived, that we could all stay here. So we'll see. But the thing that is going to maybe bite us first is really climate change, because it's a transformation that transforms everything, because it affects food and water and soil and forest, and there's nothing it doesn't affect. What I find is that people feel almost victimized, who understand it, and those who don't actually don't worry about it. But those who do understand it feel like it's like we're victims to it. But I actually see it differently. I think climate change is happening for us, not to us. It's like a blessing. It's like a messenger. And we can either take the message or turn away, but we will not be the same people, the same person, the same culture, the same cities, countries, farms, or politics if we are to make this transition, this most mysterious transition through this century, or we will perish in great number. Not all of us, but it'll be a very, 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 very difficult time. And, this is not like, okay, we got through it. I mean, the mechanism of climate change is very slow, and the buildup of carbon in the atmosphere is one that is cumulative and also very slow to change. And so, we're looking at climate regimes that for thousands of years, this isn't like, oh, we'll get it done by 2050. I mean, even if we stabilize by 2030, 40, 50, carbon emissions, the drawing down, the reduction of those emissions is an extraordinarily difficult thing. And because you get positive feedback loops. So climate change is really the one that's going to wake everybody up one by one by one. And usually it's going to wake them up by having their home flooded or their fields turned to desert or some other quote-unquote natural disaster, which is catastrophic in its impact on that region, that country, that valley, that city. And so one by one, I think people will come to that realization. Is it too soon? Is it too late? Is it enough? I don't know. But I actually feel, and I don't mean to sound like I'm whistling past the graveyard, but I actually feel like these are blessings in a sense, because they are just saying, wake up, wake up, wake up. And what exists beyond? We try to convince ourselves this is the best of all possible worlds, and I'd say no, not even close. And the answers and the solutions and the possibilities that reside out there now and in nature and beyond, Kenny Ossible, the pioneer, speaks to this very well, surpass any imagination we have of what is possible. So it's just like it's as if a curtain opened up and there's this stage that went infinitely to a new horizon, and it's just there and staring at us. And we're so blinded by it that we go, well, let's see, is that going to affect my paycheck? And it's like,
right. But that's how people live. I mean, we are just surviving from one week to the next.
I know, that's what I mean. It's not the best of all possible worlds when most people, are running out of money before they get their paycheck. It's not a good world. That's not a good place to live. It's insecure. Oh, my gosh.
But I mean, the fact that you can say that climate change is a blessing bespeaks a kind of optimism that we have the wherewithal as human beings to get through it and survive and thrive without utter and complete full-on collapse first.
Well, the future doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is the present, and what's in present now is possibility and its potency. And how that plays out is up to each of us and collectively. But there is a kind of collective wisdom that's occurring. You see it in civil society, you see it in cities, you see it in what's called the collaboration economy or the sharing economy, and you see it in extraordinary ways in which people are mobilizing themselves, moving, you know, people criticize, oh, it's, you know, 80% of the world is going to live in cities by 2050. 81% lives in cities in Brazil right now. But cities is where we have the lowest impact on Earth. And the cities are a technology, and they're being radically designed and reimagined as, it's kind of like I call them like biological arcs of the future. And you see this tremendous growth in civil society, and this what I call this humanity's immune response to economic disease and political corruption and ecological degradation. And then you see in this explosion in what's called the shareable economy, that is peer-to-peer or meshing, or there's all sorts of words for it, where we're sharing and we're saying, wait, I don't need to buy one of these, and each one of us doesn't have to buy one of these. 10 of us can buy one and share, whether it's land or Airbnb, whether it's cars, or it goes on and on and on. And this is being invented right in front of us as we speak. And it's neighbor good, not neighborhood. And it's like, which has be a radical reduction in stuff, you know, but a radical increase in collaboration, in community, in trust, which really we've lost, you know, all of that book Bowling Alone. You know, we're all isolated and feeling that isolation so keenly.
We're talking to Paul Hawken. You describe in your books various examples of what's called biomimicry, which means observing how nature works in order to make other things that work well. Do you have a vision of biomimicry to make an economy that mimics an ecosystem?
Oh yeah. I mean, as Janine Benyus has said, life does one thing. I mean, it does a million things, but at its core, life creates the conditions that are conducive to life. That's what life does. And so that is the slogan, motto, and mission should be of every business, every government, every city, every person, every school, every entity that exists on Earth. And to a certain extent it is, you know, I mean, every mom and dad, you know, is trying to create the conditions that are conducive to her or his child's life and their family's life. So it's hardwired in us. We are life. It's not like it's out there somewhere and we got to figure it out. What you see in biomimicry, though, is there's this sort of, you know, from the Age of Enlightenment right until today, there was this headlong rush into the artifice of catabolic thermal industrialism, you know, that we could outsmart nature and that we could do better. That's so alluring and has been so alluring for so long. And what biomimicry has done is saying, well, the things you want, you know, in terms of warmth and security and, you know, all the things that we want as people, you know, our daily life, these things can be provided in a much, much more elegant way than the way we're doing it right now. The way we're doing it right now creates 1 million pounds of waste per person per year in the United States. I mean, and nature, you know, really doesn't have waste. I mean, it does have waste, but that waste is always taken up by another species or system as a nutrient. And so it's just so, so elegantly economical. And we are so clumsily uneconomical. So when you think of biomimicry, you just think about just exquisiteness and elegance in design and process. And the other thing you think about is green chemistry, which is in nature, molecules want to be together. Your body is a good case in point. No matter what you eat in the morning, there you are, and they want to be together. And they're put together at room temperature with, you know, C or O and H and the other things you eat. And we use force and fire and vacuum and heavy metal catalysts and butyls and butyls but to make our world, and we wonder why there's 5 million different toxic chemicals in the world, even though we only sell about 120,000, because we are trying to force our way, and violence always produces second and third order effects. And we have an industrial system that's violent. It's so violent to the earth, to soil, to forests, to the compounds, to our children, to it's in every single way. So biomimicry is just about saying, look at nature, don't work that way, and take a close look, because it is so extraordinary. And we just didn't see it. We saw the gold in industrialism and in power I'm not gainsaying it. I'm just saying is that there's a better way, and there's a, and it's there, and it's very much in green chemistry and biomimicry.
So basically the idea is that whatever factory you might have that's producing product A, what comes out of the waste stream is non-toxic. I mean, that's the first big, huge step.
First step. Second step is that it's useful to something else
right.
on the surface. So you take Interface, that carpet company in Atlanta, Georgia, was founded by Ray Anderson, and they now, they bring in truckloads of crappy, dirty, old carpeting, okay? I mean, you know what carpet looks like after nobody wants it. They bring it in, clean it, separate it, and make beautiful new carpets out of it.
And they're saving money by doing it that way.
It took 20 years to get there. And they run these factories off methane from landfills and from solar power. So they're working towards 2020, a point where they literally use not a drop of oil or gas, natural gas, or fossil fuel, and that now they're moving, and they're also moving to what they call restoration, which is rather than being sustainable, they're moving to a point where they can actually restore, and they have a new product where they pay kids and young people in the Philippines to gather the fishing nets that are scattered everywhere on the shore that ensnare turtles and marine mammals and fish and just cause so much trouble with marine life, to gather these nets, send them into Thailand where they have a carpet factory. They make a carpet called, I think it's Wave to Wave, or I forget what it's called. It's beautiful, beautiful carpet tile made from these old fishing nets. You're looking, it looks like ocean from above, and right? You can see down, and it's just a beautiful design. And so they're even using their productive capacity to go out and gather in other people's waste in order to make a better world. So this is just an example of what companies can do, and this is biomimetic in every way. Every company can do this. They just have to want to.
So what is the path between them not wanting to right now and doing greenwashing and all the basically arrogance toward all the rest of us and externalizing the costs that we have to pay basically as a society of asthma and cancer and all this other stuff? What's the path to them doing this kind of creative biomimicry healthy economy? I mean, do they have to have a gun held to their head? Do they have to just like have some kind of conversion experience?
Yeah, it's the second one. That's what I'm saying. This whole thing is about the world having a conversion experience. I mean, it really is. I mean, one by one by one, it can't happen en masse. And what happens en masse is always troubling.
So regulation is not the path, as you're saying.
Well, regulation, you need regulation. I mean, you have it for criminal behavior, you have it for all sorts of things, and you need it to stop damage, of course. But regulation cannot create imagination. And so, yeah, you need the highest standards possible. But the way through it, the way out of it, is through imagination design, not restriction. As such, we need restriction, don't get me wrong. But I'm just saying is, like, no. You know, like when you're a child, like, no, don't touch it. It's like, we mean it. It'll hurt you, it'll burn you, you know. But at the same time, that's not how you educate a child to know. And you don't educate a world through what isn't or what shouldn't be. You educate by what could be.
Well, though restriction, as any artist knows, leads to creativity more than just a kind of total
Absolutely.
Blank canvas.
Absolutely. I mean, but the constraints are inherent in the earth, inherent in resource flow, inherent in our impact on nature. So the constraints are there. So I couldn't agree more. I mean, a breakthrough comes from limits. It does not come from license. And so when a company takes on the idea that there are limits, and then how can we then work with those in such a way that we achieve the service that our products are supposed to offer, then you get people really thinking about processes and products and materials in an entirely novel way. But you don't get that if people don't accept that there's real limits.
There's also I mean, what so many people are proposing are green taxes and carbon taxes and things like that, which are another kind of limit.
Absolutely. And those are great, too, because basically they send price signals and they equalize, you know, which you talked about earlier, externalities. And right now, you know, people benefit from actually putting on the cost of their production onto future generations or other cultures in other countries. And they basically reap the profit from that, even though the world reaps a loss. So when you tax carbon, tax waste, tax pollution, tax those very things that harm, you're also giving incentive for those people who want to do the right thing to move ahead, because now they have the veritable equal level playing field. So taxes are very powerful. Right now, what do we tax? We tax labor. So you use less of what you tax. That's just Econ 101. So we're taxing people. And so if you're a business, you say, I want to cut my costs. So I'll cut a person. But if you tax pollution, you tax carbon, you tax these other things, then oftentimes the solution is to use more people to use less stuff. And right now, we use more stuff to use less people. But so it's upside down and backwards. And so our tax system sends us the wrong signals.
Now, given the current polarized political climate and the great gap between rich and poor, and as we were talking about, so many people living kind of two paychecks away from total ruin, and the just grotesque role of money in politics, how do you see the power of ordinary citizens at this time?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I call it the sunset effect. You know, it's sort of like nothing seems more bright just before it sets. And because money and power always overreaches, it overextends. We're overextended as a country. We have, 800, 900 military bases in the world, all over the world, not here, over the world. And we're going broke, and we don't have any money. And the same with corporate power, and the oligarchy and hegemony is overreaching. You can see it in Washington, D.C. So, yeah, we're living in a time of enormous, enormous concentration of power, of wealth, and all the corruption that comes with it. But historically, you know, it's like the Yeats poem, you know, the center cannot hold. No center can hold when it doesn't exist anymore. It's so extended outward that it collapses of its own weight. The power of citizens is enormous, because the answers to almost everything we have to do is not on a global level, not on a national level, it's on a local level. You know, food and energy are the primary examples. And we don't want to just localize our food, we want to localize our energy as well. And so in so many ways, you're seeing people really reimagine their own economies, their own, the collaborative economy is one of them, by the way, but means of production and means of wealth transfer, whether it's in banking, whether it's in transportation, and you see that in transition towns, the transition, the post-carbon movement. So you're seeing people around the world sort of say, you know, have a heads up and say, you know, we've got to change Bend, Oregon. We've got to change Santa Fe. We've got to change how we work, because this way is not sustainable. This is not going to endure. And the way it works right now very much concentrates power, money, and capital into the hands of the few. And the other way, the new way, does not. And so it's distributed, it's collaborative, it's peer-to-peer, and it shifts the locus of power. The power people just wake up and do it. And, you know, we vote every day with our dollars. So how we buy, what we eat, what we do, what we, you know, how we move has a tremendous effect. And we do ourselves a disservice if we think we don't count.
We're talking to Paul Hawken. It's just about time to go, but why should people pick up their phones and call KSFR and make a donation right now?
Because it's unpolluted information. Because it's not that each person who may speak may have their own point of view or even a bias, but it's the station itself doesn't have a bias except for transparency, openness, honesty, and truth. And that's what's missing in the media. And the thing about the media is it's so smooth, you know, it goes down like pudding, that you cannot even see that basically it's manufactured information designed exactly to go down so smoothly that you don't even see the lies, you know, unless you watch Jon Stewart, in which case he unveils them every night. So, you know, public radio is the channel through which the diversity of humanity can speak. And it's not about right or left. It's about honesty and authenticity and true to oneself. And so it's like water in the desert.
Paul Hawken is an environmentalist, entrepreneur, and author of many books, including The Ecology of Commerce, A Declaration of Sustainability, and he will be speaking at the Lensic tomorrow evening, sponsored by the Green Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.